Melbourne Writers Festival acknowledges the peoples of the Kulin Nation, the traditional owners of the land on which this event was recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present. Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation recorded live at our 2023 festival. If you enjoy listening to this podcast, please consider making a donation to Melbourne Writers Festival. As a not-for-profit organisation, inspiring, thoughtful and challenging discussions like the one you are about to listen to are only made possible thanks to the generous support of people like you. Learn how you can be part of our community at mwf.com.au/support. I hope you enjoy this episode.
So Grace, early in the book, you talk about things that you loved as a kid, like running, like stand-up comedy, that you've rediscovered.
Sit-down comedy.
You've rediscovered on this stage tonight. And I was wondering about writing. Is writing something that you loved as a kid? Were you someone who always thought like, yeah, I've got a book in me, I'm going to do that one day? Or is that more something that came out of the experience of being Australian of the Year and wanting to tell your story in your own words?
Oh, I don't know if I've ever felt as though I've had a book in me. I've never eaten a book before. Although I do consume books pretty rapidly. I've always had a thirst for knowledge. I've always loved both non-fiction and fiction works. And I've always had a hankering for truth-telling, always had an interest in justice as well. When I was really young, I just really wanted to connect, and I think that's what drove me in everything that I did. I sort of just threw myself at life, and I can't identify exactly when I thought I wanted to write a book. I think it was actually in 2020 when COVID hit, and I think all of us had perhaps a little bit more free time on our hands. And what I was always interested in when it came to the experience of child sexual abuse was putting the control back in the hands of the survivors. And especially because even still, when we think about sexual abuse as this large umbrella, children continue to lose out. We see this sort of muddying, this sort of in some ways helpful relating of issues, but children are consistently seen and not heard as domestic violence, and children get lost in that picture too often. And what we see is children's experiences thought of and told subjective to the adult experience. And it's high time that children, even though they don't have equal power, have equal say. And that's been my goal, to make that happen and to give the pen, the voice and the platform back to boys and girls.
Were there books or writers or any kind of works of art that spoke to you as inspiration or motivation along the way for what would become your memoir?
It's hard to pinpoint. I've always been a comfort watcher more than I have been, or a comfort reader more than I have been a comfort eater. At times in my life when I've really struggled, I've turned to content as a safe place, or not that I really like that term personally, but I've sought solace in trying to do something actively, whether that's physically or mentally to try to get myself out of whatever is going on. And I really don't like to put parameters around what it is I'm consuming. I try to keep an open mind and an open open interests. And so I've found myself watching and reading all kinds of things and following the careers of all kinds of people who probably you might not expect somebody like me or whatever. Perhaps that's reflective of maybe how I've been painted as someone who's, you know, quote-unquote progressive, whatever that's supposed to be. But I've really liked the works of people like Christopher Lash, who wrote a really interesting book that's really stood the test of time and is very applicable to today's world when we consider who our political leaders are, or at least in recent times. He wrote a book called The Culture of Narcissism in 1979. Speaking of which, the architecture of this theatre reminds me, I wonder, it might look like what I imagine the inside of Rupert Murdoch's mouth to look like. Several layers of tiny teeth. Anyway. who else? I really like the work of David Hare, who's a great playwright and author. Many of his works have been made into films. He adapted the screenplay of, he adapted the book, the Reader, into a screenplay. I'm just now thinking about all the films and books that I've consumed. I've been reading biographies lately. I just read the biography of one of the many biographies, actually, of Robert Maxwell, who is Ghislaine Maxwell's father, called Fall, The Mystery of Robert Maxwell by John Preston. These aren't really anything to do with my life or inspired me to write my book, obviously, but I'll read anything find inspiration. I think that's perhaps a message in of itself, is to not be limited and to engage in conversation and the pursuit of information in the circles that perhaps we don't want to. Perhaps that scare us, because those are the pockets of the world that can, you know, that's the real gold dust. Yeah.
You mentioned that people have opinions of you. You're the subject of a lot of projection, I would say, and so I imagine when you were choosing how you wanted to tell your story, the question of which publisher you went with must have been important. I know that there were a few publishers interested in this book, rightfully so, and you ended up going with Pan Macmillan and your editor, Kate, and I'm wondering if there was something that they pitched to you about their vision for the book or how they would work with you in the editorial process or how they would publicise it that spoke to you when you were making that decision.
Well, it's about the vibe of the thing, isn't it? interestingly, Macmillan, in the UK at least, was owned by Robert Maxwell. That's not why I went with it. it was really about the connection, the bond, and, you know, after the first press club speech that I did in March of 2021, and a number of, you know, it was just I don't even know how to describe what that experience was after. I mean, really, it was after the Australian of the Year Awards, the speech, and a number of appearances that I had done. It was an onslaught of requests that came flooding in to me, and it wasn't really a conscious choice at that point to write a book, and And that is, I guess, a microcosm of how much of my life has been. It's always been unstable. There hasn't been a lot of, if any, design at all to it. But we did, or I did, want to go with Pan Macmillan and with Kate because there was this connection the experience of writing with Pan was, it was many things. Many opposing things can be true at once. Kate and I have a very special bond. The writing process itself, which was quite short and sharp and concentrated. I had probably 6 weeks where I was writing myself, and then Kate and I sat in a room together in the Pan Macmillan offices, where Kate just sort of was like sitting there as a sounding board, and my autistic hyper-focusing mind was just writing 6,000 words a day, and I had tapped into this dormant trauma, most of which I was quite confident speaking about. However, it's as if I was speaking about it to a certain point, but a depth beneath that I had not drilled into because it was or is so very dark, and it isn't something that we see in the mainstream for many reasons. One of which is it does remain a kind of last frontier of discomfort. And another is that child sex offenders, and I mean the more calculating, psychopathic, older recidivists, do still helm the narratives in the mainstream in a lot of ways. There's a difference between, I would like to point this out here, there's a difference between, you know, we see a lot of children actually who unintentionally engage in sexualized behaviors, often, well, in actually most cases, because they have been sexualized by these older recidivists. And what happens is they get criminalized in a lot of cases because the older recidivists are very good at hiding their behavior. They're very manipulative and very practiced. And these younger boys or girls don't know that what they're doing is wrong. And that's how we get these systems, these cycles stuck. And what we actually need to do is recognize this because, I mean, prison is not great, obviously. We could talk about that for a long time. However, in the case of these rare, fortunately rare, recidivist, psychopathic types, prison is probably the best place for these people, and that end very far away, that end of the spectrum of behavior. And then these younger kids, boys and girls, who are engaging in this sexualized behavior, we shouldn't put these people in prison because childhood is the place where we can, you know, that's where we can change a narrative. That's where we can set a particular course in motion. That's where we should be investing in education, in protection, and in the future, because children are the future. And I've gone off topic, but I sort of haven't. This is very relevant here. But what we've seen in the mainstream is how children have been chastised so often for the behaviours that they engage in, because it is much more palatable, the imagery, the stories of a child misbehaving than consuming the idea of a crime against nature. So a child doing drugs, right? See where I'm getting at? Or a child sexualized or adultified, or a child potentially having an interest in an adult, right? But that is just not true, because what child sexual abuse actually is an adult who has a fantasy that is twisted and perverted. And the reason that they pick on a child, in a lot of cases, if not most or all cases, is because a child is still a child and they are not an adult, and they are a vessel, a conduit, an object for those projections. And they are more liable to mimic and self-incriminate. And when I was working with Kate, I was still realizing this while I was writing this. And that was fucking hard. And I am 28 years old. And I was still going through this process in 2021 while I had eyes on me, and in 2022. And also while I was writing this, I had the very man who had abused me as a child writing threats, saying that he was coming for me. And I was in conversations with the police. And so when people asked me, how did the book go? I went, well, the pedophile's revenge plan didn't come to fruition, so that's great. How's your pedophile going? That's my context, which I laugh about. But that's what it's like. And I really am hoping to communicate so clearly to people that this is what boys and girls who have been abused actually live through. And it takes them so long to understand. Now, this man, at the time of reporting, he was found with not only child abuse material, but he was found with a blackmail folder, essentially. So photographs of these other girls that he had collected. Now, when I say a blackmail folder, I don't mean that it was just blackmail on these girls. It was blackmail because the parents of these girls, right? Now, that's what these types are really good at, is creating this whole system of fail-safes around them. He was also, according to the principal's 16-page statement, in his time at the school, using the school's resources to run a Ponzi scheme, like Jeffrey Epstein, to run a Ponzi scheme. And I repeat that. It is like, as a child sexual abuse survivor, trying to find yourself over the period of time after that happens to you as a child, when you are in the process of integration, when you are in the process of your anatomical, physiological, and social behaviors still forming, after that happens to you, it's like trying to find pieces of your soul in a game of three cup Monty, or more than three fucking cups, let's be real. You know? Where's that piece of my soul? They have carefully hidden parts of your own life in all these different places, in like offshore bank accounts. You know, I don't know if there's still a part of my soul that this man has got invested in some kind of, you know, in like Switzerland or something with some Nazi gold. That's not funny, but it's kind of true. And it's ridiculous. This is what it's like. And that writing process, you know, and then you finish the book, and then you go throughout the however long it's been since we finished, more things have come to light even. And, you know, I met another woman whose story I put in the book, albeit with her name de-identified on the 14th of October last year, you know, because pedophilia is, it's an organised crime. That's the end of my TED Talk.
I'm wondering if you'd be willing to read a passage from the book. This is a personal section about the day that you were announced as Australian of the Year.
Everyone's like, holy shit. I need a tinfoil hat. But it's real. You know, I've been trying to say this for a really long time and people are like, yeah, but I'm like, no, it's like this. The first one?
Yeah.
All right. Oh, no, I'm going to cry.
I'm going to cry.
I didn't see. This is the thing. I didn't cry a lot. And then I wrote this stupid book. Now I cry all the time. It's my own fault. All right. While I could not be prouder, more honoured, or more grateful to be the first public survivor of child sexual abuse to have been named an Australian of the Year, there is something I must tell you. It was a beautiful moment in history that night, one that was shared with so many, a necessary moment that, which above all was symbolic, empowering, and hopeful of what is to come. It was simultaneously one of the loneliest moments of my life because the one person who couldn't be there to share it with me was me when I was a child. She was hidden from everyone's view. My cousin Millie had handwritten me a letter. I read it in my hotel room while Max was fast asleep. It was 2 o'clock in the morning. My phone was aglow with flashing messages on the bedside table. Messages coming thick and fast. That's what she said. I had 2 hours, they said, until I had to be downstairs in the lobby, until my life wasn't mine again. I didn't know what was going on. I couldn't see the end of the day ahead of me. In those final moments of silence, I found myself. The 15-year-old girl in her uniform. And I sat with her. I held her. I cried. I was 26 then, still fighting my womanhood without a period and terrified. I didn't sleep or do my hair. I just changed my clothes and put my mask back on before I made my way to reception onto the press bus, to Parliament House, and into your living rooms.
Thank you for reading that. It's like the rest of the book, it's so beautifully honest and generous, and I think it does a lot of work in bridging the gap between how people imagine your life has been, especially, you know, during that period of winning, of being awarded Australian of the Year, and then what your actual experience was in those moments. Actually, now that we've just passed the book, can you talk a little bit about this book cover? Because as well as being a talented writer, you're also an accomplished artist. And I'm wondering, you illustrated this cover. How did that come about?
Yeah, actually, I was illustrating that while I was in, I was in a clinic. I'd taken some time just to stop, really. That was in April last year. And I don't know. I wanted to illustrate the cover, and as with any artwork, often draws itself, if that makes sense. I've always been a sort of surrealist type of realist illustrator. I've taken a lot of inspiration from people like Terry Gilliam, and you probably haven't heard of this person, but I have a little strange monstery thing on my arm. There's a Czech stop-motion animator by the name of Jan Švankmajer. Okay. Yep, all right. who made a stop-motion animation of Alice in Wonderland. Yep, okay.
that one we've heard of, I think.
The stop-motion animation version. It's got a live-action, a real girl who plays Alice, and then all of these little crafted creatures. I don't know. I just I sat down. I wanted to do something really wacky, and then Penn McMillan were like, "Yeah, but it has to be sold in Big W." So. I was like, "Oh, okay, I get it." And they're like, and then I had some other ideas, and they're like, "But it has to be recognizable as your book." And it's like, "Oh, okay." And then I was like, "Oh, it has to have my face on it." Okay, and I was like, "I'll go you one better. I'll put two pictures on my face." Yes, and then so it just sort of sprang from there. And I love animals and nature, and so. Yeah, I just sort of started having a little bit of fun drawing it, but it wasn't really finished because, again, this, I guess he's a beast, isn't he? Started his little threatening thing while I was in there. And we had to delay the illustration everything. So, yeah. But it's just an homage to some things. There's some symbols in there that are representative. I'd have to have a look at it. I don't remember. Yeah. So we've got a little chameleon in there. So scorpions are the only known predator of the rock spider. And Max is a Scorpio.
Is your partner?
He's my fiance.
Wait, you say in the book that you don't believe in astrology. You're a Capricorn who doesn't believe in astrology. Is that right?
That's right. No. Exactly. I don't believe in astrology. It's one of those things. I always take things with a grain of salt. I'm quite happy to listen, and you know. I've got lots of friends who are interested in it, and they like to tell me things, and I go, "Oh, whatever." I think I'm just too logically inclined, but I do like those sorts of coincidences and things. And I actually do really, I do believe in omens and things like that. And anyone familiar with Homer's Odyssey would know about the sort of the themes and omens and like homecoming and testing and birds being pretty common themes and things like that. I've seen a lot of omens in my life. Perhaps that's sort of similar to astrology. I don't know. But I tend to be pretty logical. I do like numbers a lot. I don't know. Anyway.
So you've mentioned that throughout the writing process and even the illustration process, that the perpetrator of the abuse that you underwent was popping up on Twitter threatening you. You went to Twitter about it and the police.
Yeah, but it's just because he's trying to be relevant, but
He's really not. He's just a coward who's just, you know, whatever. Yeah, I was pretty stunned that he was still able to grab your attention, be in the public eye in that way at all. That disruption to your life still...
It's because he's got nothing to do. He just needs to take up knitting or something.
So how was the book publication process? Because it once again sort of flung you into the limelight. You were doing media appearances, book festival appearances. How did that go as compared with your appearances and media experiences after becoming Australian of the Year?
I don't really know. I mean, we're always doing work though. So always traveling around and going to community events and talking and, you know, campaigning and I don't know. I think I certainly enjoy this more than talking to politicians. Thanks, guys. You're welcome anytime. I always try to hang, like my favourite thing is hanging back with audiences afterwards. And I know they said, you know, Grace is not going to stay around and sign books. And I'm always like, damn it. Because I always love to hang back afterwards. And I was in Cairns for the Writers Festival there and it's a smaller community and it was a smaller event and Max wasn't there because Max is usually the one who's kind of like keeping me in line and making sure that my autistic self doesn't just like go off and, you know, do stuff or whatever. Max wasn't there and I was signing books afterwards and ha ha ha. I then invited like 9 stragglers to dinner with me afterwards. I didn't know these people. I was just like, hey, do you want to go and get pasta? And we just went across the street and just went and got pasta. I did not know these people, but it was great. I can't take you all to dinner, I'm very sorry. Would that I could. I actually would. You can see how I could probably get taken for a ride, couldn't you? Unfortunate, but true.
And so... When you say you're kind of travelling around talking to politicians and writers' festivals, etc., is that part of your work with the Grace Tame Foundation?
It is, yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about the foundation? And are you the CEO and director? Girlboss?
Sounds fancy. CEOs, it doesn't really mean anything. It does, actually. I shouldn't say that. There's probably a Murdoch spy in here going... Oh, that probably got me at the joke that I made before, actually. Fuck that. I mean, you work for Murdoch. That's a joke. Fuck. I've spent half of my career defaming that man. Anyway. The foundation has 3 very clear things that it focuses on. In the area of child protection. So we aim to create a future free from child sexual abuse, which is an ambitious goal, but a noble one, all the same. So survivor support is one, and we mainly do that through philanthropy. So we work closely with a team of lawyers in Sydney, at a firm called Mark Lawyers. And what we do is we use most of our funds to pay for the legal work of child sexual abuse survivors. So that's where most of our money goes. We're just in the process of hiring 2 new staff. One is a project officer and one is a media manager. But otherwise, really, because none of the directors, we don't draw wages. There's 4 of us at the moment, and then there'll be 3 staff, the Paris, who's a psychologist, well, actually technically 4 staff, Paris and Eleanor, who are the psychologists who triage all the disclosures that we get. And then those two other staff that I mentioned before. But yeah, most of the money just goes to paying those legal fees. And then the other two areas of focus are the education piece, which is a lot of what I do through travelling around and speaking about not just the child sexual abuse itself, the incidents, because I think that's what has been part of the problem of why we don't get anywhere, is there's just all this hype or focus or sensationalism. And we get what pedophiles do, okay? They rape children, they molest children. We understand that. We hear about it all the time. And what I want to do is shift that to the behaviour patterns, to the precipitating schemes, like I said, this Ponzi scheme, like, well, it literally is this Ponzi scheme framework of roping all of these other accessories, whether they're human accessories or other elements in to create this whole network of, or this ecosystem of abuse through grooming, through trafficking, through solicitation, through stalking, surveilling. I mean, that's what grooming is. It's this whole operation. That's what I want people to understand. Because a lot of that is real, it is, it's entirely real. But the huge piece that it does rely on is us believing that we have to be scared of it, and that there are, like, that we have to protect their reputation over the lives of children, which is just not true, right? And the other piece, the other area of focus is the structural reform lobbying. So trying to create better legislation and policies in the interest of children. We've got a lot of policies that are about, oh, yeah, well, you know, like equal rights for perpetrators and children. And it's like, what? Equal rights. That's predicated on the premise that they're equal in the first place, and they're just not. Seriously, that's just not true. So trying as best we can to listen to the needs of not just adult survivors who've had the experience, but what are the needs of children in the first place, and working towards reforming our structures. That's what we did. Just a few small things.
Yes. So there were some legal changes introduced in the South Australian Parliament this week around some language. Was the Greystone Foundation involved with that?
Yeah, we drove that. So back in 2020, Nina Fennell, who's a journalist based in New South Wales, she led the hashtag Let Her Speak, or created and runs the hashtag Let Her Speak and Let Us Speak campaigns. And through those campaigns, it came to the attention of her and us, really, that the wording of the offence that my perpetrator was charged with was abhorrent. And that's what led the wording to be changed there. I think actually...
Is that because it contained the word relationship?
Yeah. So the offence down there in Tasmania at that time was maintaining a relationship with a person under the age of 17. Now, it's important to understand that in law, there are provisions for children who are having sex with each other. Okay? This is not what we're trying to... stop here, and the law recognises also when there is like an age gap as well for, like, you know, children who are a bit younger who might have sex with an older child, that is also factored in to the law. And this is also the offense specifically of repeated offenses. So it's that in of itself it is in recognition of a crime where it, by virtue of it happening a lot of times, you know, there's bound to have been grooming. This is a crime where you usually get, it's a child and a much older person. Because even in the case of a child who is already like isolated, you know, all children are vulnerable, but even in the case of a child who's already isolated, they're already like destabilized. They might be, you know, in a vulnerable, even more vulnerable environment, like a home or a care facility or something like that. Often pedophiles will go for children in, you know, residential care or something like that. You do have to go through, like as a pedophile, you have to go through a lot of steps to procure a child, you know? Like it's just such a manipulative crime. And so when you use terminology like relationship, and another argument for that is, oh, well, it's just, that's all it is. It's just stating that it's a connection. It's just a neutral word. But again, neutral. It's not neutral. We need to recognize that it is this projected fantasy into this underdeveloped mind. The biochemistry of a child is so volatile. The hormones of a child are so volatile. And it does leave a different imprint. And whilst a lot of people say, oh, you can't compare traumas, well, the thing is, we have to. So at some point, this is one of the things that I struggle with progressive logic, of this charade of political correctness where, you know, like I would never compare myself to a war veteran. I don't know what that's like. So there's adult on adult crime, and whilst I'm not taking away from the trauma of adult experiences of abuse, when you have a fully formed sense of self and something happens to you when you're an adult and you haven't been neglected or abused as a child, again, I'm not taking away from that trauma of whatever has happened, but you usually tend to have the abilities, the resources to identify what has happened and can go and seek help. You might not, but you have a fully formed sense of self. It's a complete sense of self that even if it has been taken away, you can hark back to. But if it happens to you while you're a child, in the process of forming your sense of self, it is the very process of the forming of the sense of self, that process of integration that has also been corrupted. And that is what makes child sexual abuse different. You know? That's why we have to separate that out and just be able to do that. And just go, all right, let's draw that line.
Going back to the book, or in the book you say that you would like to write another book one day, or several books. What would do you think that they would be on this topic, or as part of the Grace Team Foundation goal, or something else?
Yeah, I mean, I've got quite a few books that I'd like to write. I'd like to write one on the sexual blackmail economy, which is probably not a very funny book, but fascinating all the same. I love the Cold War. Really love the Cold War, which is a very broad term, loosely. Really, the Cold War is just lots of little proxy wars under this Cold War banner. What else? I don't know. Yeah.
You think it would be non-fiction or fiction? Would you ever write fiction?
I don't know. Probably not. Maybe. Who knows? I just feel like history is... I'm really fascinated by history, and also by how it's written or not written. And I'm also really fascinated by like philosophy and economics and the philosophy of economics. People are starting to fall asleep now. the relationship of media structure and power dynamics and things like that. Probably, maybe I should write a book about like the politico-media complex. Would people read that if I wrote it?
I think people are nodding their heads, yeah.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. Yeah, especially because I feel like one of the things I've been mulling over lately is how, especially in the West, and I think this is something that needs to be said out loud, because when it really would be easily misinterpreted if it was written down, is that in the West, through the lenses of fiction media and whitewashed history, we're really taught to think in the modern era, I think say maybe in the last like 100 years or so, we're really taught to think like the, you know, Nazi Germany and religious extremists in the Middle East and the communists are the most evil forces in the world. And whilst there's no denying that, you know, those forces are evil, evil is a universal thing. And the atrocities that have been committed in the West as well have not been covered properly, I don't think. And that is something that I would like to write about. Because I don't think we know our history properly. Like, you know, we just are always just pointing the finger. Like, how many movies have been made about the Second World War just going, look at those Nazis, they're so evil, look at those Nazis. I mean, Nazi scientists were captured by the US forces and their work was continued. You know this, right? Yeah. I mean, this is that. Tinfoil hat. It's like, anyway, it's another book.
Next one.
I get in trouble from my, sorry, I'm laughing because the other day I was on the microphone at this event talking about Kincora Boys Home, which I'm writing about at the moment, especially. Is it, there's something going on in the UK at the moment, some special thing or something, isn't there?
Boo.
Yeah, exactly, Kincora. And all of the pedophile rings running around the royal family. And one of the board members of the foundation is this brilliant criminologist, doctor of criminology, Mike Salter, who also sits on the board of this international organisation. And he was like, Grace, don't mention some of the stuff they did in the US. Don't mention that. And I was like, I was just talking about that at the premiere of the SBS documentary the other day. And he was like, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't do that. No, don't do it. Whoops. So I won't say anything else.
But where are you going to be publishing this piece about what's happening in the UK this weekend?
On The Shot.
Is that a website?
Yep.
Okay.
The Shot is, the Chaser guys. And that's their kind of serious paper. Serious. Yeah. I mean, their tagline is proud and profane. Much to my mother's disgust. But, oh, well. Anyway, they write fun stuff. Yeah. Sometimes I don't necessarily agree with everything that's put out, but, I also just don't know where else to. I was writing for the Sydney Morning Herald, and then they did that. Well, I mean, before that, I was sort of like, Costello, Costello. And then they did that Red Scare stuff, and I just went, what the hell are you doing? This is straight out of 1952 US propaganda. And literally, I was like, I also have seen this graphic somewhere. And then I was like, that's right. This is the poster from Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove. It literally actually is the poster. And then I put them side by side on my Instagram story. And I was like, look, it's the same thing. It's actually the same graphic. It was very, very, very sad. So, yeah, anyway. Don't buy into that absolute garbage, please. Like, come on. Yeah.
I'd love to end the session by having you read one last section, if you're up for it. This is another piece. It's the second piece, Mark.
This is what happens when you write a book. They make you read it.
As I mentioned earlier, you write in the book that running is something that you loved as a kid, you sort of lost during your teen years, and then you've rediscovered in more recent years, including going on the second date you had with your partner was like a 10K run. That wasn't particularly relatable, but I really admired it.
Max and I are both nuts, by the way. We're just absolute larrikin nutheads. Yeah. Which is great. We found each other.
So, yeah, this is a piece. This is a passage in the book about a marathon that you ran a couple of years ago.
Where do I start? Okay, where do I stop?
There, at the end of the passage.
There, okay. On the 10th of October 2020, Mum and I got up at dawn to drive to the Midland Tasmanian town of Ross. Don't go there. Mum brought her book and chair and set herself up at different spots over the course of the 4-lap race route. All I wanted to do was crack 3 hours. At the start of the gun, I flew. Too hard, too soon. That's what she said. That would be my first lesson. For the opening 3 kilometres, I ran alongside the man who won in 2 hours and 37 minutes. I ran the first 10 kilometres in 39 minutes, but I had no concept of how to race for longer than 21 kilometres. And I'd only done so once, 7 months earlier in Santa Monica, where I'd finished my first half marathon, 58 seconds shy of 90 minutes. All the longer training runs I'd done over that distance were tempo speed at best. Seeing my cousin Eloise line up for the half marathon and hearing her cheers at the 21 kilometre mark, which I made in 1 hour and 25 minutes, gave me a much-needed lift. But I also heard myself say, I have to do that all over again, as I entered the third grueling lap. By that stage, the sun was high and I was already cramping. Earlier, I hadn't been able to take in the fuel I'd brought. All I had was my handheld water pouch. The next female runner was 15 minutes behind me. And the male leaders were way out ahead. I was running alone. I stopped looking at my watch. It wasn't making me any faster. The only thing I could do was run. By lap 4, I wasn't running with my body. If I had listened to the pain, I'd have stopped. I was moving with my mind. With 7 kilometres to go, I found myself at the wall. Marathon runners speak of, which would have you defeated in an instant. What happened next would stop me from falling to my aching knees and ultimately get me across the line. Suddenly, I was surrounded. 10 years before that, just the sight of one tall man would have made me freeze. In that moment, a whole group of them circled me so that all I could see was their bodies and the pavement beneath my feet. It was just little me, walled in by giant men. They told me that they had my back. They told me to stick with them. 10 years after I had been stripped of my love of running by one man, isolated and terrified, lying on my back, wishing I didn't exist, I crossed the finish line as the clock ticked over 2 hours, 59 minutes, and 31 seconds, smiling through tears, embraced by my mother and cousin and friend Millie, buoyed by the solidarity of a community who believed in me and helped me believe in myself. Yeah. The victory that day was not the race. It was survivorship, transforming and transcending through love.
Thank you so much, Grace. I feel like that passage just perfectly encapsulates the strength and resilience and humor that's on display in this book. And the value that comes across too, which is just this, the importance of community support and allyship in lifting each other up and helping each other through.
Yeah. And look, if anyone tells you that they've run a marathon and it's a good fucking time, they're lying to you. It is hard to do that.
Same with writing a book, I think, actually.
That is true. Yeah. It is so hard. I mean, it is the process of writing a book, like I said, it is many things. It is empowering and energizing and exciting, but it is also so grueling and confronting because you I mean, it depends on what you're writing about, but you have to become the book. You have to give yourself over to this thing. You have to be prepared to do nothing but the book and be nothing but the book. You have to live and breathe, you know, and huff the book, you know. That's what you are. And you don't really see anyone. You don't really do anything, you know. You have to just, yeah. It's your religion, yeah, and it's so, like I said before that, I hadn't gone to those places and then it made me realize why it does take on average 23.9 years for child sexual abuse survivors to unpack those layers and find all the cards in you know, three card or, you know, the whole deck of card Monty. You can see why. And you can see why a lot of people don't ever want to go there and why that is actually quite brave to do. Because when you do it, all the people in your life, you know, it's been something for my family that's been really hard too. Like my mother, you know, both my parents actually, I mean, yeah, both my parents grew up in working class families. I mean, my dad grew up in, for a time, they were just living in one shed while my grandfather was building the house, and then that shed and the house that my grandfather was almost finished working on just got ripped to the ground by the 1967 bushfires. And my mum, she's one of nine sisters, and, you know, both of them worked their way up into the middle classes, did really, you know, pretty well for themselves. And finally, when my mum got to the point of going to being able to afford to go to university, you know, Bester was there. And he wasn't just there, you know, he was menacing people.
Your perpetrator.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. I just should stop referring to him by his name, assuming that people know who he is, because he is so irrelevant and meaningless. But he was there on campus when she was there. And again, like, and I, you know, he's crafted this narrative of like, oh, people were bothering me and I'm such a victim. And it's like, well, no, you weren't just there using your time to carry on with your new life. You were actively menacing people. And that's why people were concerned, is because it should be a place where people are, like, people who haven't had a chance at their life yet. Like, you've had a chance at your life and this is what you did with it. And now you're still menacing people. And like, mum never got to do a degree and she still hasn't got a degree, you know, and, you know, she's had to go through like 2 criminal trials now. She's given all her time to helping with that. And like, you know, my brother's grown up through this and, you know, my stepdad as well has had to support my mum through it all. And, you know, like Max and I have been together for 2.5 years, and in the middle of 2021, Max, who had himself grown up through, you know, he had this mission to, you know, he went through primary school and then worked his way all through high school, and he just wanted to get a job, a stable job, and he's, you know, like in finance, and he, you know, got himself a chartered accountancy and like master's in financial planning, and got himself a job, and then, you know, he was all set up, and then just quit his job so that he could help me. Like, there's just so much that is like, and because of everything that's happened in the last 2.5 years especially, it's just like, you know, there's a lot that doesn't get seen, and we see it firsthand at the foundation too. A lot of the legal work, for example, that is done, or the, you know, that we and that we assist with the funds, because I read as the CEO for the approvals, I read a like brief case history of every individual, and it's both civil and criminal. And for a lot of survivors, if they're not financially strapped to begin with, they might be at the end, because it is 10, sometimes longer, or sometimes more years that they will be dragged through the courts, because often perpetrators individually or institutions cynically abuse the legal system. And I am looking at you, Catholic Church.
Sorry to interrupt you, Grace, but I've just realised we've gone a little bit over time.
Oh, no.
But thank you. Thank you for, through the work with your foundation and through this book, kind of teasing out how complicated this is,
so complicated,
and how complicit so many of our institutions are. The book is available for sale. Grace won't be signing it, but we're all going out for pasta tonight. thank you so much for joining us, and please thank my guest, Grace Taylor.
It's chilly.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this discussion and would like to support Melbourne Writers Festival, visit mwf.com.au/support.